4. About a week after the welcoming dinner and Dearborn's disastrous, hurtful remark to her, the retarded slops fella from the Traveler's Rest, Sheamy, folks called him, had appeared at the house Susan and her aunt shared. In his hands he held a large bouquet, mostly made up of the wildflowers that grew out on the drop, but with a scattering of dusky wild roses as well. They looked like pink punctuation marks. On the boy's face there had been a wide, sunny grin as he swung the gate open, not waiting for an invitation. Susan had been sweeping the front walk at the time. Aunt Cord had been out back in the garden. That was fortunate, but not very surprising. These days the two of them got on best when they kept apart as much as they could. Susan had watched Sheamy come up the walk, his grin beaming out from behind his upheld freight of flowers, with a mixture of fascination and horror.
"Good day, Susan Delgado, daughter of Pat," Sheamy said cheerfully. "I come to you on an errand and cry your pardon at any troublation I be. Oh, aye, for I am a problem for folks, and know it same as them. These be for you. Here."
He thrust them out, and she saw a small folded envelope tucked amongst them.
"Susan?"
Aunt Cord's voice from around the side of the house and getting closer.
"Susan, did I hear the gate?"
"Yes, aunt,"
she called back, curse the woman's sharp ears. Susan nimbly plucked the envelope from its place among the phlox and daisies. Into her dress pocket it went.
"They from my third best friend," Sheamy said. "I got 3 different friends now. This many."
He held up 2 fingers, frowned, added 2 more, and then grinned splendidly.
"Arthur Heath, my first best friend. Dick Stockworth, my second best friend. My third best friend..."
"Hush," Susan said, in a low, fierce voice that made Sheamy's smile fade. "Not a word about your 3 friends." A funny little flush, almost like a pocket fever, raced across her skin. It seemed to run down her neck from her cheeks, then slip all the way to her feet. There had been a lot of talk in Hambry about Sheamy's new friends during the past week. Talk about little else, it seemed. The stories she had heard were outlandish. But if they weren't true, why did the versions told by so many different witnesses sound so much alike? Susan was still trying to get herself back under control when Aunt Cord swept around the corner. Sheamy fell back a step at the sight of her, puzzlement becoming outright dismay. Her aunt was allergic to bee stings and was presently swaddled from the top of her straw brera to the hem of her faded garden dress in gauzy stuff that made her look peculiar in strong light and downright eerie in shade. Adding a final touch to her costume, she carried a pair of dirt-streaked garden shears in one gloved hand. She saw the bouquet and bore down on it, shears raised. When she reached her knee, she slid the scissors into a loop on her belt, almost reluctantly, it seemed, to the niece herself, and parted the veil on her face.
"Who sent ye those?"
"I don't know, aunt," Susan said, much more calmly than she felt.
"This is the young man from the inn."
"Inn?" Aunt Cord snorted.
"He doesn't seem to know who sent him,"
Susan carried on. If only she could get him out of here.
"He's... well, I suppose... you'd say he's
a fool, yes, I know that."
Aunt Cord cast Susan a brief, irritated look, then bent her attention on Sheamy. Talking with her gloved hands upon her knees, shouting directly into his face, she asked,
"Who sent these flowers, young man?"
The wings of her face veil, which had been pushed aside, now fell back into place. Sheamy took another step backward. He looked frightened.
"Was it, perhaps, someone from Seafront? From Mayor Thorin? Tell me, and I'll give you a penny."
Susan's heart sank. Sure he would tell. He'd not have the wit to understand he'd be getting her into trouble. Will, too, likely. But Sheamy only shook his head.
"Don't remember. I got an empty head, Si, so I do... Stanley says I a bug wit."
His grin shone out again, a splendid thing, full of white, even teeth. Aunt Cord answered it with a grimace.
"Oh, foo! Be gone, then. Straight back to town, too. Don't be hanging around hoping for a goose feather. For a boy who can't remember deserves not so much as a penny."
And don't you come back here again, no matter who wants you to carry flowers for the young Sai. Do you hear me?
Shimi had nodded energetically. Then,
Sai?
Aunt Cord glowered at him. The vertical line on her forehead had been very prominent that day.
Why you all wrapped up in cobwebby, Sai? Get out of here, you impudent cull!
Aunt Cord cried. She had a good loud voice when she wanted to use it, and Shimi jumped back from her in alarm. When she was sure he was headed back down the high street toward town and had no intention of returning to their gate and hanging about in hopes of a tip, Aunt Cord had turned to Susan.
Get those in some water before they wilt, Miss Oh-So-Young and Pretty, and don't go mooning about wondering who your secret admirer might be.
Then Aunt Cord had smiled, a real smile. What hurt Susan the most, confused her the most, was that her aunt was no cradle-story ogre, no witch like Rhea of the Coos. There was no monster here. Only a maiden lady with some few social pretensions, a love of gold and silver, and a fear of being turned out penniless into the world.
"For folks such as us, Susie Pie," she said, speaking with a terrible, heavy kindness, "'tis best to stick to our housework and leave dreams to them as can afford 'em."
5. She had been sure the flowers were from Will, and she was right. His note was written in a hand which was clear and passing fair. Dear Susan Delgado, I spoke out of turn the other night and cry your pardon. May I see you and speak to you? It must be private. This is a matter of importance. If you will see me, get a message to the boy who brings this. He is safe. Will Dearborn. A matter of importance. Underlined. She felt a strong desire to know what was so important to him and cautioned herself against doing anything foolish. Perhaps he was smitten with her. And if so, whose fault was that? Who had talked to him, ridden his horse, showed him her legs in a flashy carnival dismount? Who had put her hands on his shoulders and kissed him? Her cheeks and forehead burned at the thought of that, and another hot ring seemed to go slipping down her body. She wasn't sure she regretted the kiss, but it had been a mistake, regrets or no regrets. Seeing him again now would be a worse one. Yet she wanted to see him, and knew in her deepest heart that she was ready to set her anger at him aside. But there was the promise she had made. The wretched promise. That night she lay sleepless, tossing about in her bed, first thinking it would be better, more dignified, just to keep her silence, then composing mental notes anyway, some haughty, some cold, some with a lace edge of flirtation. When she heard the midnight bell ring, passing the old day out and calling the new one in, she decided enough was enough. She'd thrown herself from her bed, gone to her door, opened it, and thrust her head out into the hall. When she heard Aunt Cord's flute-like snores, she had closed her door again, crossed to her little desk by the window, and lit her lamp. She took one of her sheets of parchment paper from the top drawer, tore it in half. In Hambry, the only crime greater than wasting paper was wasting threaded stock line, and then wrote quickly, sensing that the slightest hesitation might condemn her to more hours of indecision. With no salutation and no signature, her response took only a breath to write.
I may not see you. 'Twould not be proper.
She had folded it small, blew out her lamp, and returned to bed with the note safely tucked under her pillow. She was asleep in 2 minutes. The following day, when the marketing took her to town, she had gone by the Traveler's Rest, which at 11 in the morning had all the charm of something which has died badly at the side of the road. The saloon's dooryard was a beaten dirt square bisected by a long hitching rail with a watering trough beneath. Shimi was trundling a wheelbarrow along the rail, picking up last night's horse droppings with a shovel. He was wearing a comical pink sombrero and singing Golden Slippers. Susan doubted if many of the rest's patrons would wake up feeling as well as Shimi obviously did this morning. So who, when you came right down to it, was more soft-headed? She looked around to make sure no one was paying heed to her, then went over to Shimi and tapped him on the shoulder. He looked frightened at first, And Susan didn't blame him. According to the story she'd been hearing, Jonas's friend DePape had almost killed the poor kid for spilling a drink on his boots. Then Sheamy recognized her.
"Hello, Susan Delgado from out there by the edge of town," he said companionably. "It's a good day, I wish you, Si."
He bowed, an amusing imitation of the inner barony's bow favored by his three new friends. Smiling, she dropped him a bit of a curtsy. Wearing jeans, she had to pretend at the skirt-holding part, but women in Magus got used to curtsying and pretend skirts.
"See my flowers, Si?"
he asked, and pointed toward the unpainted side of the rest. What she saw touched her deeply, a line of mixed blue and white silk flowers growing along the base of the building. They looked both brave and pathetic, flurrying there in the faint morning breeze, with the bald, turd-littered yard before them and the splintery public house behind them.
"Did you grow those, Sheamy?" "Aye, so I did, and Mr. Arthur Heath of Gilead has promised me yellow ones."
"I've never seen yellow silk flowers."
"No, we know, me neither, but Mr. Arthur Heath says they have 'em in Gilead."
He looked at Susan solemnly, the shovel held in his hands as a soldier would hold a gun or spear at port arms.
"Mr. Arthur Heath saved my life. I'd do anything for him."
"Would you, Sheamy?" she asked, touched.
"Also, he has a lookout. It's a bird's head. And when he talks to it, tendy pretend, do I laugh? I fit to split."
She looked around again to make sure no one was watching, save for the carved totems across the street, then removed her note, folded small, from her jeans pocket.
"Would you give this to Mr. Dearborn for me? He's also your friend, is he not?"
"Well, aye."
He took the note and put it carefully into his own pocket.
"And tell no one."
"Shh," he agreed and put a finger to his lips. His eyes had been amusingly round beneath the ridiculous pink lady's straw he wore.
"Like when I brought you the flowers. Hushaboo."
"That's right, hushaboo. Fare ye well, Sheamy."
"And you, Susan Delgado."
He went back to his clean-up operations. Susan had stood watching him for a moment, feeling uneasy and out of sorts with herself. Now that the note was successfully passed, she felt an urge to ask Sheamy to give it back, to scratch out what she had written and promise to meet him. If only to see his steady blue eyes again, looking into her face. Then Jonas's other friend, the one with the cloak, came sauntering out of the mercantile. She was sure he didn't see her. His head was down and he was rolling a cigarette, but she had no intention of pressing her luck. Reynolds talked to Jonas, and Jonas talked, all too much, to Aunt Cord. If Aunt Cord heard she had been passing the time of day with the boy who had brought her the flowers, there were apt to be questions, one she didn't want to answer. 6.
"All that's history now, Susan. Water under the bridge. Best to get your thoughts out of the past."
She brought Pylon to a stop and looked down the length of the drop at the horses that moved and grazed there. Quite a surprising number of them this morning. It wasn't working. Her mind kept turning back to Will Dearborn. What bad luck meeting him had been. If not for that chance encounter on her way back down from the Coos, she might well have made peace with her situation by now. She was a practical girl, after all, and a promise was a promise. She certainly never would have expected herself to get all goosey-gushy over losing her maidenhead, and the prospect of carrying and bearing a child actually excited her. But Will Dearborn had changed things, had gotten into her head and now lodged there, a tenant who defied eviction. His remark to her as they danced stayed with her like a song you can't stop humming, even though you hate it. It had been cruel and stupidly self-righteous, that remark. But was there not also a grain of truth in it? Rhea had been right about Hartthorne, of that much Susan no longer had any doubt. She supposed that witches were right about men's lusts even when they were wrong about everything else. Not a happy thought, but likely a true one. It was Will be damned to you, Dearborn, who had made it difficult for her to accept what needed accepting, who had goaded her into arguments in which she could hardly recognize her own shrill and desperate voice, who came to her in her dreams, dreams where he put his arms around her waist and kissed her, kissed her, kissed her. She dismounted and walked downhill a little way with the reins looped in her fist. Pylon followed, willingly enough, and when she stopped to look off into the blue haze to the southwest, he lowered his head and began to crop again. She thought she needed to see Will Dearborn once more, if only to give her innate practicality a chance to reassert itself. She needed to see him at his right size, instead of the one her mind had created for him in her warm thoughts and warmer dreams. Once that was done, she could get on with her life and do what needed doing. Perhaps that was why she had taken this path, the same one she'd ridden yesterday, and the day before yesterday, and the day before that. He rode this part of the drop. That much she had heard in the lower market. She turned away from the drop, suddenly knowing he would be there, as if her thought had called him, or her ka. She saw only blue sky and low ridgeline hills that curved gently like the line of a woman's thigh and hip and waist as she lies on her side in bed. Susan felt a bitter disappointment fill her. She could almost taste it in her mouth like wet tea leaves. She started back to Pylon, meaning to return to the house and take care of the apology she reckoned she must make. The sooner she did it, the sooner it would be done. She reached for her left stirrup, which was twisted a little, and as she did, a rider came over the horizon, breaking against the sky at the place which looked to her like a woman's hip. He sat there, only a silhouette on horseback, but she knew who it was at once.
"Run!" she told herself in a sudden panic. "Mount and gallop! Get out of here, quickly, before something terrible happens, before it really is Ka, come like a wind to take you and all your plans over the sky and far away!"
She didn't run. She stood with Pylon's reins in one hand and murmured to him when the Rocio looked up and nickered a greeting to the big bay-colored gelding coming down the hill. Then Will was there, first above her and looking down, then dismounted in an easy, liquid motion she didn't think she could have matched for all her years of horsemanship. This time there was no kicked-out leg and planted heel, no hat swept over a comically solemn bow. This time the gaze he gave her was steady and serious and disquietingly adult. They looked at each other in the drop's big silence, Roland of Gilead and Susan of Magus, and in her heart she felt a wind begin to blow. She feared it and welcomed it in equal measure. Seven. "Good morn, Susan," he said. "I'm glad to see you again." She said nothing, waiting and watching. Could he hear her heart beating as clearly as she could? Of course not. That was just so much romantic twaddle. Yet it still seemed to her that everything within a 50-yard radius should be able to hear that thumping. Will took a step forward. She took a step back, looking at him mistrustfully. He lowered his head for a moment, then looked up again, his lips set. "I cry your pardon," he said.
"Do you?"
Her voice was cool. "What I said that night was unwarranted." At that she felt a spark of real anger.
"I care not that it was unwarranted. I care that it was unfair, that it hurt me."
A tear overbrimmed her left eye and slipped down her cheek. She wasn't all cried out after all, it seemed. She thought what she said would perhaps shame him, but although faint color came into his cheeks, his eyes remained firmly on hers.
"I fell in love with you," he said. "That's why I said it. It happened even before you kissed me, I think."
She laughed at that, but the simplicity with which he had spoken made her laughter sound false in her own ears. Tinny. Mr. Dearborn, Will, please. Mr. Dearborn, she said, patiently as a teacher working with a dull student, the idea is ridiculous. On the basis of one single meeting, one single kiss, a sister's kiss? Now, she was the one who was blushing, but she hurried on. Such things happen in stories, but in real life, I think not. But his eyes never left hers, and in them she saw some of Roland's truth, the deep romance of his nature buried like a fabulous streak of alien metal in the granite of his practicality. He accepted love as a fact rather than a flower, and it rendered her genial contempt powerless over both of them. "I cry your pardon," he repeated. There was a kind of brute stubbornness in him. It exasperated her, amused her, and appalled her all at the same time. "I don't ask you to return my love. That's not why I spoke. You told me your affairs were complicated." Now his eyes did leave hers, and he looked off toward the drop. He even laughed a little. "I called him a bit of a fool, didn't I? To your face. So who's the fool after all?" She smiled, couldn't help it. "He also said ye'd heard he was fond of strong drink and berry girls." Roland hit his forehead with the heel of his hand. If his friend Arthur Heath had done that, she would have taken it as a deliberate comic gesture. Not with Will. She had an idea he wasn't much for comedy. Silence between them again, this time not so uncomfortable. The two horses, Rusher and Pylon, cropping contentedly side by side. If we were horses, all this would be much easier, she thought, and almost giggled. "Mr. Dearborn, ye understand that I have agreed to an arrangement." "Aye," he smiled when she raised her eyebrows in surprise. "It's not mockery, but the dialect. It just seeps in."
"Who told ye of my business?"
"The mayor's sister."
"Coral."
She wrinkled her nose and decided she wasn't surprised. And she supposed there were others who could have explained her situation even more crudely. Eldred Jonas for one, Rhea of the Coos for another. Best to leave it.
"So if you understand, and if you don't ask me to return your... whatever it is you think you feel, why are we talking? Why do you seek me out? I think it makes you passing uncomfortable."
"Yes," he said. And then, as if stating a simple fact, "it makes me uncomfortable, all right. I can barely look at you and keep my head."
"Then mayhap it'd be best not to look, not to speak, not to think."
Her voice was both sharp and a little shaky. How could he have the courage to say such things, to just state them straight out and starry-eyed like that?
"Why did you send me the bouquet and that note? Are you not aware of the trouble you could have gotten me into if you knew my aunt? She's already spoken to me about you, and if she knew about the note or saw us together out here..."
She looked around, verifying that they were still unobserved. They were, at least as best she could tell. He reached out, touched her shoulder. She looked at him, and he pulled his fingers back as if he had put them on something hot. "I said what I did so you'd understand," he said. "That's all. I feel how I feel, and you're not responsible for that."
"But I am," she thought. "I kissed you. I think I'm more than a little responsible for how we both feel, Will."
"What I said while we were dancing, I regret with all my heart. Won't you give me your pardon?"
"I,"
she said. And if he had taken her in his arms at that moment, she would have let him and damned the consequences. But he only took off his hat and made her a charming little bow, and the wind died. "Thank you, Si."
"Don't call me that. I hate it. My name is Susan."
"Will you call me Will?" She nodded. "Good. Susan, I want to ask you something. Not as the fellow who insulted you and hurt you because he was jealous. This is something else entirely. May I?"
I suppose,
she said warily. "Are you for the affiliation?" She looked at him, flabbergasted. It was the last question in the world she had expected, but he was looking at her seriously. "I'd expected ye and your friends to count cows and guns and spears and boats and who knows what else," she said. "But I didn't think thee would also count affiliation supporters." She saw his look of surprise and a little smile at the corners of his mouth. This time the smile made him look older than he could possibly be. Susan thought back across what she'd just said, realized what must have struck him, and gave a small, embarrassed laugh. "My aunt has a way of lapsing into thee and thou. My father did, too. It's from a sect of the old people who called themselves friends." "I know. We have the friendly folk in my part of the world still."
"Do you?"
"Yes. Or I, if you like the sound of that better. I'm coming, too. And I like the way the friends talk. It has a lovely sound."
"Not when my aunt uses it," Susan said,
thinking back to the argument over the shirt.
"To answer your question, I'm for the affiliation, I suppose, because my dad was. If you ask, am I strong for the affiliation, I suppose not. We see and hear little enough of them these days. Mostly rumors and stories carried by drifters and far-traveling drummers. Now that there's no railway..."
She shrugged. "Most of the ordinary day-to-day folk I've spoken to seem to feel the same. And yet your Mayor Thorin..."
"He's not my Mayor Thorin," she said,
more sharply than she had intended. "And yet the Barony's Mayor Thorin has given us every help we've asked for, and some we haven't. I have only to snap my fingers, and Kimber Rymer stands before me."
"Then don't snap them,"
she said, looking around in spite of herself. She tried to smile and show it was a joke, but didn't make much success of it. "The townsfolk, the fisher folk, the farmers, the cowboys, they all speak well of the affiliation, but distantly. Yet the mayor, his chancellor, and the members of the Horsemen's Association, Langle and Garber and that lot..."
"I know them,"
she said shortly. "They're absolutely enthusiastic in their support. Mention the affiliation to Sheriff Avery, and he all but dances. In every ranch parlor, we're offered a drink from an eld commemorative cup, it seems."
"A drink of what?"
she asked a trifle roguishly.
"Beer? Ale? Graff?"
"Also wine, whiskey, and pettibone," he said, not responding to her smile. "It's almost as if they wish us to break our vow. Does that strike you as strange?"
"Aye, a little. Or just as Hambry hospitality. In these parts, when someone, especially a young man, says he's taken the pledge, folks tend to think him coy, not serious."
"And this joyful support of the affiliation amongst the movers and the shakers, how does that strike you?"
"Queer."
And it did. Pat Delgado's work had brought him in almost daily contact with these landowners and horse breeders, and so she, who had tagged after her dad any time he would let her, had seen plenty of them. She thought them a cold bunch, by and large. She couldn't imagine John Croydon or Jake White waving an Arthur Eld Stein in a sentimental toast, especially not in the middle of the day, when there was stock to be run and sold. Will's eyes were full upon her as if he were reading these thoughts. "But you probably don't see as much of the big fellows as you once did," he said, "before your father passed, I mean."
"Perhaps not. But do bumblers learn to speak backward?"
No cautious smile this time. This time he outright grinned. It lit his whole face. Gods, how handsome he was. "I suppose not. No more than cats can change their spots, as we say. And Mayor Thorin doesn't speak of such as us, me and my friends, to you when you two are alone? Or is that question beyond what I have a right to ask? I suppose it is."
"I care not about that," she said, tossing her head pertly enough to make her long braids swing. "I understand little of propriety, as some have been good enough to point out."
But she didn't care as much for his downcast look and flush of embarrassment as she had expected. She knew girls who liked to tease as well as flirt, and to tease hard, some of them, but it seemed she had no taste for it. Certainly she had no desire to set her claws in him. And when she went on, she spoke gently.
"I'm not alone with him in any case.
And oh, how ye do lie, she thought mournfully, remembering how Thorin had embraced her in the hall on the night of the party, groping at her breasts like a child trying to get his hand into a candy jar, telling her that he burned for her. Oh, ye great liar. In any case, Will, Hart's opinion of you and your friends can hardly concern ye, can it? Ye have a job to do, that's all. If he helps ye, why not just accept and be grateful? Because something's wrong here, he said, and the serious, almost somber quality of his voice frightened her a little. Wrong? With the mayor? With the Horsemen's Association? What are you talking about? He looked at her steadily, then seemed to decide something. I'm going to trust you, Susan.
I'm not sure I want thy trust any more than I want thy love, she said.
He nodded. And yet to do the job I was sent to do, I have to trust someone. Can you understand that? She looked into his eyes, then nodded. He stepped next to her, so close she fancied she could feel the warmth of his skin. Look down there. Tell me what you see. She looked, then shrugged. The drop, same as always. She smiled a little. And as beautiful. This has always been my favorite place in all the world. Aye, it's beautiful, all right. What else do you see?
Horses, of courses.
She smiled to show this was a joke, an old one of her dad's, in fact. But he didn't smile back. Fair to look at, and courageous if the stories they were already telling about town were true, quick in both thought and movement, too. Really not much sense of humor, though. Well, there were worse failings. Grabbing a girl's bosom when she wasn't expecting it might be one of them. Horses, yes. But does it look like the right number of them? You've been seeing horses on the drop all your life, and surely no one who's not in the Horsemen's Association is better qualified to say.
And ye don't trust them?
They've given us everything we've asked for, and they're as friendly as dogs under the dinner table. But no, I don't think I do.
Yet, ye'd trust me.
He looked at her steadily with his beautiful and frightening eyes, a darker blue than they would later be, not yet faded out by the suns of 10,000 drifting days. I have to trust someone, he repeated. She looked down, almost as though he had rebuked her. He reached out, put gentle fingers beneath her chin, and tipped her face up again. Does it seem the right number? Think carefully. But now that he'd brought it to her attention, she hardly needed to think about it at all. She had been aware of the change for some time, she supposed, but it had been gradual, easy to overlook.
No, she said at last. It's not right.
Too few or too many? Which? She paused for a moment, drew in breath, let it out in a long sigh.
Too many. Far too many.
Will Dearborn raised his clenched fists to shoulder height and gave them a single hard shake. His blue eyes blazed like the sparklights of which her granddad had told her.
I knew it, he said. I knew it.
8. How many horses are down there? He asked.
Below us? Or on the whole drop?
Just below us. She looked carefully, making no attempt to actually count. That didn't work, it only confused you. She saw 4 good-sized groups of about 20 horses each, moving about on the green almost exactly as birds moved about in the blue above them. There were perhaps 9 smaller groups, ranging from octets to quartets. Several pairs, they reminded her of lovers, but everything did today, it seemed. A few galloping loners, young stallions mostly. 160? He asked in a low, almost hesitant voice. She looked at him, surprised.
Aye, 160's the number I had in mind, to a pin.
And how much of the drop are we looking at? A quarter? A third?
Much less. She tilted him a small smile, as I think thee knows. A sixth of the total open graze, perhaps.
If there are 160 horses free grazing on each sixth, that comes to... She waited for him to come up with 960. When he did, she nodded. He looked down a moment longer and grunted with surprise when Rusher nosed him in the small of the back. Susan put a curled hand to her mouth to stifle a laugh. From the impatient way he pushed the horse's muzzle away, she guessed he still saw little that was funny. "How many more are stabled or training or working, do you reckon?" he asked.
"One for every three down there, at a guess.
So we'd be talking 1,200 head of horses, all threaded stock, no muties." She looked at him with faint surprise.
"Aye, there's almost no mutie stock here in Mages, in any of the outer baronies, for that matter."
"You true breed more than three out of every five?"
"We breed 'em all. Of course, every now and then we get a freak that has to be put down, but not one freak out of every five live births. One out of five born with, how would Renfrew put it, with extra legs or its guts on the outside?"
Her shocked look was enough answer.
"Who's been telling you such?"
"Renfrew. He also told me that there was about 570 head of threaded stock here in Mages."
"That's just..."
She gave a bewildered little laugh.
"Just crazy. If my dad was here..."
"But he's not," Roland said, his tone as dry as a snapping twig. "He's dead." For a moment she seemed not to register the change in that tone. Then, as if an eclipse had begun to happen somewhere inside her head, her entire aspect darkened.
"My dad had an accident. Do you understand that, Will Dearborn? An accident. It was terribly sad, but the sort of thing that happens sometimes. A horse rolled on him. Ocean foam. Fran says Foam saw a snake in the grass."
"Fran Lengil?"
"Aye."
Her skin was pale, except for two wild roses, pink like those in the bouquet he'd sent her by way of Shimi, glowing high up on her cheekbones.
"Fran rode many miles with my father. They weren't great friends, they were of different classes, for one thing, but they rode together. I've a cap put away somewhere that Fran's first wife made for my christening. They rode the trail together. I can't believe Fran Lengel would lie about how my dad died, let alone that he had anything to do with it."
Yet she looked doubtfully down at the running horses. So many. Too many. Her dad would have seen. And her dad would have wondered what she was wondering now, whose brands were on the extras. It so happens Fran Lengel and my friend Stockworth had a discussion about horses, Will said. His voice sounded almost casual, but there was nothing casual on his face. Over glasses of spring water after beer had been offered and refused. They spoke of them much as I did with Renfrew at Mayor Thorin's welcoming dinner. When Richard asked Cy Lengel to estimate riding horses, he said perhaps 400.
"Insane."
"It would seem so," Will agreed.
"Do they not ken it? The horses are out here where you can see them."
"They know we've barely gotten started," he said, "and that we've begun with the fisher folk. We'll be a month yet, I'm sure they think, before we start to concern ourselves with the horse flesh hereabouts. And in the meantime, they have an attitude about us of... how shall I put it? Well, never mind how I'd put it. I'm not very good with words. But my friend Arthur calls it genial contempt. They leave the horses out in front of our eyes, I think, because they don't believe we'll know what we're looking at, or because they think we won't believe what we're seeing. I'm very glad I found you out here. Just so I could give you a more accurate horse count, is that the only reason?
But you will get around to counting the horses. Eventually, I mean, that must surely be one of the affiliation's main needs."
He gave her an odd look, as if she had missed something that should have been obvious. It made her feel self-conscious.
"What? What is it?"
"Perhaps they expect the extra horses to be gone by the time we get around to this side of the barony's business."
"Gone where?"
"I don't know. But I don't like this. Susan, you will keep this just between the two of us, won't you?" She nodded. She'd be insane to tell anyone she'd been with Will Dearborn, unchaperoned except by Rusher and Pylon, out on the drop. It may all turn out to be nothing, but if it doesn't, knowing could be dangerous. Which led back to her dad again. Lengel had told her and Aunt Cord that Pat had been thrown, and that Ocean Foam had then rolled upon him. Neither of them had had any reason to doubt the man's story. But Friend Lengel had also told Will's friend that there were only 400 head of riding stock in Magus, and that was a bald lie. Will turned to his horse, and she was glad. Part of her wanted him to stay, to stand close to her while the clouds sent their long shadows flying across the grassland. But they had been together out here too long already. There was no reason to think anyone would come along and see them. But instead of comforting her, that idea for some reason made her more nervous than ever. He straightened the stirrup hanging beside the scabbarded shaft of his lance. Rusher whickered way back in his throat as if to say about time we got going. Then turned to her again. She actually felt faint as his gaze fell upon her, and now the idea of Ka was almost too strong to deny. She tried to tell herself it was just the dim, that feeling of having lived a thing before. But it wasn't the dim. It was a sense of finding a road one had been searching for all along. There's something else I want to say. I don't like returning to where we started, but I must.
No, she said faintly. That's closed, surely.
I told you that I loved you and that I was jealous, he said. And for the first time, his voice had come unanchored a little, wavering in his throat. She was alarmed to see that there were tears standing in his eyes. There was more. Something more.
Will, I don't want to...
She turned blindly for her horse. He took her shoulder and turned her back. It wasn't a harsh touch, but there was an inexorability to it that was dreadful. She looked helplessly up into his face, saw that he was young and far from home, and suddenly understood she could not stand against him for long. She wanted him so badly that she ached with it. She would have given a year of her life just to be able to put her palms on his cheeks and feel his skin. You miss your father, Susan.
Aye, she whispered. With all my heart, I do.
I miss my mother the same way. He held her by both shoulders now. One eye overbrimmed. One tear drew a silver line down his cheek.
Is she dead?
No, but something happened. About her. To her. Shit. How can I talk about it when I don't even know how to think about it? In a way, she did die. For me.
Well, that's terrible.
He nodded. The last time I saw her, she looked at me in a way that will haunt me to my grave. Shame and love and hope, all of them bound up together. Shame at what I'd seen and knew about her. Hope, maybe, that I'd understand and forgive. He took a deep breath. The night of the party, toward the end of the meal, Reimer said something funny. You all laughed.
If I did, it was only because it would have looked strange if I was the only one who didn't. Susan said, I don't like him. I think he's a schemer and a conniver.
You all laughed, and I happened to look down toward the end of the table, toward Olive Thorin. And for a moment, only a moment, I thought she was my mother. The expression was the same, you see, the same one I saw on the morning when I opened the wrong door at the wrong time and came upon my mother and her. Stop it! She cried, pulling back from his hands. Inside her, everything was suddenly in motion. All the mooring lines and buckles and clamps she'd been using to hold herself together seeming to melt at once.
Stop it! Just stop it! I can't listen to you talk about her!
She groped out for Pylon, but now the whole world was wet prisms. She began to sob. She felt his hands on her shoulders, turning her again, and she did not resist them.
I'm so ashamed! She said. I'm so ashamed and so frightened, and I'm sorry. I've forgotten my father's face. And
I'll never be able to find it again, she wanted to say, but she didn't have to say anything. He stopped her mouth with his kisses. At first she just let herself be kissed, and then she was kissing him back, kissing him almost furiously. She wiped the wetness from beneath his eyes with soft little sweeps of her thumbs, then slipped her palms up his cheeks as she had longed to do. The feeling was exquisite. Even the soft rasp of the stubble close to the skin was exquisite.
She slid her arms around his neck, her open mouth on his, holding him and kissing him as hard as she could, kissing him there between the horses, who simply looked at each other and then went back to cropping grass. Nine. They were the best kisses of his whole life, and never forgotten. The yielding pliancy of her lips and the strong shape of her teeth under them, urgent and not shy in the least, the fragrance of her breath, the sweet line of her body pressed against his. He slipped a hand up to her left breast, squeezed it gently, and felt her heart speeding under it. His other hand went to her hair and combed along the side of it, silk at her temple. He never forgot its texture. Then she was standing away from him, her face flaming with blush and passion, one hand going to her lips, which he had kissed until they were swollen. A little trickle of blood ran from the corner of the lower one, her eyes wide on his, her bosom rising and falling as if she had just run a race. And between them a current that was like nothing he had ever felt in his life. It ran like a river and shook like a fever.
"No more," she said in a trembling voice. "No more, please. If you really do love me, don't let me dishonor myself. I've made a promise. Anything might come later after that promise was fulfilled, I suppose, if you still wanted me."
"I would wait forever," he said calmly, "and do anything for you, but stand away and watch you go with another man."
"Then, if you love me, go away from me. Please, Will."
Another kiss. She stepped forward at once, raising her face trustingly up to his, and he understood he could do whatever he wanted with her. She was, at least for the moment, no longer her own mistress. She might, consequently, be his. He could do to her what Martin had done to his own mother, if that was his fancy. The thought broke his passion apart, turned it to coals that fell in a bright shower, winking out one by one in a dark bewilderment. His father's acceptance, I have known for 2 years, was in many ways the worst part of what had happened to him this year. How could he fall in love with this girl, any girl, in a world where such evils of the heart seemed necessary and might even be repeated? Yet he did love her. Instead of the passionate kiss he wanted, he placed his lips lightly on the corner of her mouth where the little rill of blood flowed. He kissed, tasting salt like the taste of his own tears. He closed his eyes and shivered when her hand stroked the hair at the nape of his neck.
"I'd not hurt Olive Thorin for the world," she whispered in his ear. "No more than I'd hurt thee, Will. I didn't understand. And now 'tis too late to be put right. But thank you for not taking what you could. And I'll remember you always, how it was to be kissed by you. It's the best thing that ever happened to me, I think. Like heaven and earth all wrapped up together. Aye."
"I'll remember, too." He watched her swing up into the saddle, and remembered how her bare legs had flashed in the dark on the night he had met her. And suddenly he couldn't let her go. He reached forward, touched her boot. "Susan."
"No," she said, "please."
He stood back. Somehow.
"This is our secret," she said. "Yes?"
"Aye." She smiled at that, but it was a sad smile.
"Stay away from me from now on, Will, please, and I'll stay away from you."
He thought about it. "If we can."
"We must, Will, we must."
She rode away, fast. Roland stood beside Rusher's stirrup, watching her go. And when she was out of sight, over the horizon, still he watched.